Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Don and Dude.
Say hello to my little podcast. It's not that little, is it?
It's getting bigger every day.
That's true. This is the Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Don with me. Don, you ready to talk about 1983?
Grody to the max.
I knew you were going to do one of those. Wasn't it Gag Me with a Spoon
in 1982? Yeah,
yeah. Okay. This is the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums, the album format, and finding all kinds of dumb ways to talk about them. We've got a great show for you today. We're continuing our love of the 80s and journeying through that decade, focusing on 1983. So Don and I will each be bringing an album to talk about, but we have a little restriction. They had to be R&B and pop albums. I would have loved to have gone metal in 1983. That's when it starts getting fun. Mm-hmm. Don's going to ask us a deep question. Then we'll have some shout outs to some other albums and album related items we're digging. And then we'll spin the wheel of musical discovery to learn what types of albums we'll be talking about from 1984. But this time, it's all about
1983.
That's what I'm talking about.
The I Love the 80s tour hits 1983. Cable news chatter, primetime soaps about oil money and shoulder pads, and glossy mail-order catalogs sell a new kind of lifestyle. Personal computers glow on office desks, game consoles plug into living room TVs, and kids trade stickers and plastic figurines at recess. Rock and pop tighten their sound with crisp studio tricks and big choruses, while deeper grooves and slow burns reshape contemporary R&B. Today, one of us digs into an R&B record, and the other brings a pop record from 1983. So hitch up those high-waisted jeans, put a stamp on another mail-order music club offer, and meet us at Chuck E. Cheese's. This is 1983.
So when you plugged your Atari into your TV, remember that weird little toggle you had, the slider thing?
Yep. TV or computer, it would say. Yeah.
From Radio Shack, usually.
Yep.
So, yeah, in the R&B and pop worlds, for R&B, there would have been one choice for me if that had been my responsibility, and it would have been Lionel Richie, Can't Slow Down, but mm-hmm. we talked about it not too long ago on a Motown episode, so I felt like my hands would have been tied.
Yeah.
There's also a Donna Summer record, She Works Hard for the Money, and Aretha Franklin's Get It Right, but...
Yeah, not a great year.
Not as many things in that space. It starts getting even better, like 84, 85, that's... The kind of stuff I liked anyway. What about pop? What would you have been looking at?
Well, in my world, New Order, kind of their first big album where they kind of, you know, created their new sound, moving away from Joy Division, Power, Corruption, and Lies. We actually talked about that record a few years ago. So we could, you know, it was fine to wait. Billy Joel, An Innocent Man.
I loved that album.
Uptown Girl is on that. Yeah.
And For the Longest Time and Tell Her About It.
Yeah, that was a big one.
My parents had that one. One of the records they played that I enjoyed.
Yep. Eurythmics had two albums in 1983, Sweet Dreams and Touch.
Mm, I know there were two.
The Tears for Fears debut, The Hurting.
Very emotional.
Yeah.
Yep. And Madonna's Madonna before. Right. You know, there were some hits on that one, but before it really went crazy with Like a Virgin. Okay, well, those were some of the things we could have gone with, but didn't for various reasons. So the picks are in. The cassette has been rewound.
Had to use the pencil to...
the cassette was torn. I had to fix it with scotch tape and then rewind it with the pencil. Let's get to our cha-cha-cha choices.
You choose me?
I dug deep for an R&B selection from 1983.
You did.
It comes from Womack and Womack, and the album is called Love Wars. So Womack and Womack is Cecil Womack, or Cecil, I think it's Cecil. Cecil Womack and his wife, Linda Womack.
I think it's Linda.
Linda is actually Sam Cooke's daughter.
Okay.
Now, there's the Womack brothers. So there's Cecil, there's Bobby Womack, who you may have heard of
before. I was all kinds of confused when it came to who's who here.
Yeah, and there's a Curtis in there as well. So
I only knew of Bobby Womack. I had not heard of the other Womacks.
Yeah, so the Womack brothers used to perform with Sam Cooke. And then, you know, after he passed away, Bobby Womack ended up marrying Linda's mother, so Sam Cooke's widow.
Okay.
And looks like Bobby and Linda, though, when she was 17, had a little relationship, kind of weird. But at some point, Cecil and Linda got married.
Wait, so Cecil's her uncle?
Step-uncle. Step-uncle and husband. Yeah.
Interesting. All right. Yeah, Maybe that's why there are so many love wars.
Yeah. But Cecil had actually written a lot of songs for his previous wife, Mary Wells, who had a few hits. Very, very musical group. So this is actually the debut album as a duo. Let's get right to it. Here's Love Wars, the title track.
So were they trying to cash in on the whole Star Wars?
Oh, maybe
thing. You know, if there had been some like lasers at the beginning, then I would have been suspicious.
Well, there's definitely a force in this.
God, it's strong with this one for sure.
So Love Wars was written by Cecil and Linda, and in fact, the two of them have songwriting credits on almost all of the tracks. I guess the lyrical content supposedly draws directly from their own tangled family history. And some marital conflict.
So I was right.
Yes. I don't know. It is, maybe you'd call it like synth soul pop kind of, there's a lot of synthesizers mixed in here.
There's some funk elements, but like kind of growed up funk.
Yeah. It definitely feels more 70s-ish than I think than Michael Jackson at the time. Like, I feel like there's more connection to that 70s era stuff.
Yeah.
But it definitely has modern sounds with the synthesizers.
More soul and less pop.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate the album's central metaphor being up front here with the opening track, you know, how it's all about relationships and stuff and how they can be battlegrounds. And
love is a battlefield.
It's true. But it positions love like it's something fought over rather than surrendered to.
Mm.
And the taut rhythm section and the arrangements are sort of restrained, but then it opens up. So maybe it's that vibe of the wars, the back and forth, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. I was, like I said, I mean, I struggled to find an R&B record. So I was just going off of lists and I popped this one in and this song hit me somehow. I'm like, ooh, I dig this. I even like the harmonies at the beginning. You know, it just kind of starts with that, love, whoa.
That sounds just like that too.
I'll talk more about it, but I think this is kind of a hidden gem from that era.
I think so too.
Yeah,
I was surprised, and again I assumed it was Bobby Womack and then looked into it. I'm like, who the hell is this guy? It's cool. And being that they have been songwriters for other people, and definitely the songwriting is of a higher caliber than you would typically find on somebody you're unfamiliar with.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on to another track. This is Baby, I'm Scared of You. So, Baby, I'm Scared of You was, again, written by Cecil Womack and Linda Womack. Also, some credit to Eddie Gipp Noble Jr. You know, kind of has maybe a little more of a gospel vibe in it, I think. The song was actually, a minor hit in the UK. Didn't really make a huge splash in the United States, even on the R&B charts. You know, I think it peaked like at number 37 or something. But the lyrics are kind of the idea of being wary of a smooth talker, uses magician metaphors. You know, I think there's a mention of Houdini and stuff like that, you know, mm-hmm. trying to trick you. So I think the songwriting on this album is really solid. And I think whereas like a lot of R&B and pop albums of the era, you know, they were often songs from different songwriters, and maybe that mm-hmm. hurts the overall vibe of those albums. And I think here it's very consistent.
Well, it sort of subverts the traditional R&B mass masculinity thing. I was relieved that Baby, I'm Scared of You was not more ominous.
Yeah.
Or about an abusive relationship kind of a thing. But Linda's vocals are really intriguing here. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of restrained again. It's sort of sparse. It just sort of lets the vocals and the song be what they are. Nothing's being forced, and I like that.
Yeah, there's a slight maybe Diana Ross vibe, but more soulful, I think.
I could hear that.
Maybe a little more gospel-y. Mm-hmm.
But also a little less big,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
Less attitude.
Yeah. Are you going to do that thing where you go, attitude again? No?
No, I won't.
Okay.
All right. Well, was there a cut you wanted to highlight from Love Wars?
There were a couple I found interesting, one of which was made famous by other singers and written by Womack and Womack. But the one I chose was actually written by the Rolling Stones. Mm. And it's one of the few covers on here. It's Angie.
Angel. Beautiful angel, now you're trying to save.
So clearly and obviously a cover of the 1973 ballad Angie from Goat's Head Soup, which we did talk about
over the
summer. It transformed it from a rock like heartbreak song into more of a mature, soulful R&B heartbreak song. But more about celebrating Angie and that whole, like, the way they're phrasing Angie sounds more like angel. And in the original song, there is that line where Mick says angel to refer to Angie.
Mm-hmm.
But did you hear that where it just sounds like angel?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I think that was a stylistic choice there.
Yes, I think so.
Not an accent. Mick Jagger's original raw vocal had more despair, and the Womacks here control it, give it nuance, and it's more about reflection, you know? What did you think about this?
It really sounds like it was meant to sound this way, you know? I mean, it's so perfectly done. I wouldn't have imagined, you know, this kind of cover, but it works.
But I remember when we talked about Goat's Head Soup, Angie was one of those vulnerable moments that set it apart because of its vulnerability. But then this version is more so.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think this type of treatment from the Stones would have worked. I think
no.
The raw, dirty version of it works great for what, you know, for the original intention. And this is a really nicely done, not reinterpretation, but definitely through someone else's heart.
Yeah. Reminds me, just a year or two later, Billy Ocean did The Long and Winding Road.
Right.
We just talked about that recently. Kind of similar vibe.
But yeah, it is a nice reference point for how covers can honor an original song without redefining it and also without exploiting it.
Mm.
This was done because this song, I feel like they did this because one of them was moved by this song and they wanted to take a stab at it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, it does come near the end of the album, and it is a nice sort of breakup from the rest of it. All right, well, we come to the end of the record with a song called Good Times.
When it hits you, you will smile and pray for the good times, baby, good times.
So this one, again, was written by Cecil and Linda, but also Bobby Womack helped out with the songwriting here as well. I believe on several of the tracks, his voice is in there. And I think the other brother, Curtis's voice is there. And he plays some rhythm guitar. So it's a family affair.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the track sort of points toward emotional endurance, continuity after conflict, like all the wars. Although Angie did fit in with the narrative of, you know, the overall relationship stuff, this kind of brings us back to earth a little bit. And I think it sort of suggests resolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
And it sort of reinforces that idea that love remains complicated, but it's worth it.
Yes. I guess initially I hadn't thought of it as a concept album, but it kind of is. You know, I mean, you just have those kind of recurring themes and that metaphor of violence and war. But like you said before, it's not real violence. You know, it's the struggle of emotions and connecting with someone.
In the Love Wars, when there's that scene where Cecil is like, Linda, I am your uncle. You remember that? Everyone was so shocked, like no one could believe it.
Well done. All right, well, let's rewind and reflect on Love Wars. I'll start with my clickbait headline. Love Wars turns marriage counseling into a funky, synthy living room soul soap opera.
Wow. You made that harder than yourself.
I did. I sure did. You know, again, this was just a pleasant surprise. You know, I mean, it's just a good sounding, soulful record from this era. You know, I think all the songs are, you know, very well written and arranged, and the performances are excellent. It's, yeah, it's, I'm a fan of this record.
Yeah, I feel similarly, and I will prove it with my clickbait headline. Sparth synths, they're there. They're sparse. Crisp rhythms and emotional truth. Love Wars is sophista-funk at its finest.
Ooh, I
know we love doing the sophista,
yeah,
but pop, sophista, whatever.
Sophista-funk.
It did feel like grown-up funk a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But the album's emotionally rich, conceptually focused, and most importantly, thematically consistent. And that's what makes it work and why it's intriguing, even though it's like, who? But they keep it funky, you know?
Yes.
There are moments where you find the groove. I liked
it. Killer to filler. You know, there's, I think all the tracks are solid. I think you had mentioned, or you were alluding to, was it TKO?
Uh-huh.
Which was the one that was made more famous by
Teddy Pendergrass.
Yes, Teddy Pendergrass.
The king of Quiet Storm.
Yes. Yeah, I guess this kind of, It's not really a seductive album, right? So it's not quite Quiet Storm.
I think songs like TKO, I think do fit.
Oh, that's true. But yeah, that's a good track. And then I think it's followed by another abbreviation, APB. Yeah.
That might be, I mean, I was intrigued by that, but since it's right after TKO and then they actually have to say All Points Bulletin.
Right, in case people didn't know.
Right. It's lower on my list. Mm. Not quite filler, but in that realm, just where it's like, I like it. I like the idea of it, but I wish they hadn't had to explain it.
Right.
Don't use it if you have to explain it. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's clever.
Yes.
I know. I get what they were trying to do there. Woman. What do you think about that one? I liked it.
Yeah. I think Linda really sounds great on that one. Feminine strength and allure. You know, that's
yeah,
good track. I like Catch and Don't Look Back. That one, you know, just had that little hook in there, the response, and that would stay in my head for several hours afterwards.
Express Myself, I liked too.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little more rhythm forward, but it was more about emotional honesty. But it added a little momentum, I think, early in the album, and that it was a good placement for that one.
Yeah, it's really no duds. I mean,
no.
I mean, maybe my least favorite track is the final, the Good Times.
Right.
But that, you know, I think that worked as a closer.
Mm-hmm.
Production, it was produced by Stuart Levine, who actually had produced, I think, a couple of the Simply Red albums when they were cranking out UK hits.
Interesting.
And in America. Yeah, I think you mentioned it before. It's somewhat restrained.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the direction some of this R&B went in the 80s. You know, they were holding back a little bit. It was more about a smooth experience.
Yeah, I think it was the counter to the disco inflection of music, R&B music and soul music up to that point. So, yeah, I think it was kind of slowing things down a little.
Replay value?
Yeah, I mean, if I stumble on this at a record store, I'm totally buying it.
Yeah.
You know,
yep.
The replay value is really in passing it on to anyone that likes this genre or this time period, because I am 90% sure they'll be like, what?
Yeah.
What's this? Because I was. And like you said, I think it's a hidden gem.
Yes. And the legacy, you know, again, I think this treatment sort of, I think in the 80s, maybe beginning with the, you know, George Benson and Quincy Jones, you're sort of getting this smoother approach. And it, you know, it ends with like the Anita Bakers and.
Yeah. I think this is like a touchstone for emotionally honest R&B, more poetic, getting a little deeper.
Yeah, and it does seem like one that people are revisiting, or, you know, kind of going back to, you know, because they didn't notice it at the time. So Love Wars remains a testament to how family harmony and honest songwriting can anchor an album, even when it's dressed in the sleek production and synthesizers of the era. Give it a spin. Tell us what you think.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
It's time again for Deep Questions by Don. So, were there any significant music-related moments or developments in 1983?
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective and my memory, being an elementary school-aged kid at the time, the emergence, the breakthrough of metal as an actual thing, Quiet Riot's Metal Health album hit number one on the Billboard charts.
It was huge.
And it opened the doors for the whole glam metal thing. You know, everything that came after your Def Leppards and then onto Motley's and Poison's and Twisted Sister and all that stuff. I feel the door got kicked open by Quiet Riot for whatever reason. You know, I wouldn't call them the Nirvana of pop metal, but, you know, in terms of impact and in opening the door. And then, of course, also we had Metallica and Slayer with Kill 'Em All and No Mercy. The thrash metal genre was starting to form, influenced by new wave of British heavy metal. It's America's take on it, kind of. So a lot of good stuff going on in that realm. So for me, looking back, like at the time, it wouldn't have been I wouldn't have said that.
Right. But
now that's how I see it. What about you?
Well, in the electronic realm, there were some huge developments. One is the development of MIDI, which is music instrument digital interface. And so that was just a way in which you could connect multiple synthesizers and drum machines. You could basically, you know, just be one person and having multiple instruments. And that was very important to the development of synth pop and techno at the time. And then there was also the Yamaha DX7.
You've talked about that before.
Yeah. And I guess it was actually, it had a ton of preset sounds because nobody actually could figure out how to program the sounds themselves except for Brian Eno or Peter Gabriel. But at one point, I guess in 1986, almost half of the number one hits, you know, on the Billboard Hot 100, used the E-Piano 1 preset.
Wow.
Yeah. And then also in the 40% of the country number ones and 60% of the R&B number ones from that year used a preset from that keyboard. So
cool.
Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty influential. And I assume Yamaha did not get a chunk of all of those songs.
Yeah, I don't know. You would think they might.
It's not a sample, because I doubt they had copyright on that sound. I don't know.
Right. I mean, it's not like Fender can get royalties for...
Oh, you played a C-sharp. give me money.
All right. What are some other significant developments from 1983? Let us know on our social media like Instagram and Facebook at Album Nerds.
So in the pop space, I felt like my choice was very clear. We've tried to find other venues to talk about this album before, and finally, she's here. Cyndi Lauper with She's So Unusual from October of 1983, produced by Rick Chertoff. I don't know why it came out that way.
Do you think when she was arguing with the producer, she'd be like, maybe I shouldn't have come at all, Chertoff?
I hope so. That's a reference to Cable Guy, right?
Yes.
Well, maybe I shouldn't have come at all. Chertoff!
Oh, yes. Cyndi Lauper, born Cynthia and Stephanie Lauper in New York City in 1953, raised in Brooklyn and Queens, grew up in a troubled home. Her stepdad was a real creep. I guess she had a really great relationship with her father, but when her parents divorced, that all fell apart. And as a teen, she moved out to live with her older sister to get away from the creepy stepdad. So, you know, it was a struggle. And I think that struggle is part of what made her who she was as an artist later. Known for a 4-octave voice, vivid sense of style, blend of pop, rock, new wave influences really did inform her solo breakthrough. She's So Unusual peaked at number 4 on Billboard 200, lyrically explored themes of independence, emotional vulnerability, humor thrown in there, and iconic album cover with that Annie Leibovitz was the photographer on.
I did not know that.
And she was the first female artist to have 4 top 5 singles from her debut album.
Wow.
Won Grammys. It went well for her. Once she got through, it went well. Why don't we start off with the opening track, Money Changes Everything. So interestingly, on this album, I believe only 4 of the 10 tracks are written by Cyndi Lauper. Yeah, it could be, she's a newcomer, the label wanted her to do established songs, who knows? Or maybe she just had some stuff she really liked out there. She had been in cover bands previously, so I'm not sure the reason, but on albums moving forward, she had a lot more writing credits. So I suspect the record label had something to do with that.
Yeah, I had heard, maybe just from interviews with her, it does sound like she was really fighting for, you know, control. Artistic control, that, you know, even during this time.
Yeah. So this one, Money Changes Everything, was written by Tom Gray from the Atlanta rock band The Brains. Failed commercially. Mm-hmm. Apparently, it was on an album produced by Steve Lillywhite. I did listen to it. It's not as interesting as this. Her vocal range just changes.
Yeah.
All of any of these songs that are covers, her ability to sing is outshines to me the originals. Little changes, lyric from she to I in the story, but it's got lots of 80s new wave synths. She really leaned into the new wavy stuff, but really poppy at the same time. And just a song about the impact of money on relationships and whether you have money or don't, it's probably going to destroy your relationship.
Yeah, this is the rockinest track on the album.
I agree.
You know, it still has that kind of punk rock vibe. And I like that she chose this as the opening song. I imagine people who had, you know, heard the first hit might not have been expecting, you know, a sound like this, you know, for the album. But yeah, I mean, her treatment of the song, I think, is excellent. You know, it has a real edge, and you know, you feel, you know, like this is a, you know, an empowered female singing at you. You know, nice melodica solo in there.
Yeah,
from the guy from the Hooters.
Not from the restaurant Hooters.
No, the band.
All right. Well, so we started off with the opening track being a cover. Why don't we jump to my favorite song, I think a lot of people's, and a really career-defining moment of change, I think, in pop music. This one is Time After Time. From deep inside, the drum beats out of time. If you're lost, you can look and you will find me. Certainly the emotional centerpiece of the album. It's a quiet, vulnerable ballad. There's this kind of counterweight to the sort of energetic, anthemic, new wave style. I remember seeing this video when I was a little kid too, and like crying.
Yeah, that's a pretty emotional video. I think the guy in it was her
real
boyfriend and manager, I think, maybe.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, it focuses on this sort of, like this, at least in the video, the relationship is breaking up, but I'll always be there for you anyway. I'll never stop caring about you. And that could be in any kind of human relationship. It doesn't have to be a romantic one. But her voice and the realness, the rest, you know, with the sort of flashy fun stuff, this was a really nice moment to be like, I'm a serious person too, a serious artist, and I think about stuff that isn't just having fun, you know?
Yes.
But it's about enduring loyalty. It's nice.
Yeah, it's a great song. And so, yeah, so it was co-written with Hyman from the Hooters. Also, the other Hooter, Eric Bazillion, plays guitar on this.
All right. Two hoots.
two hoots.
What's a hoot? That's a my cousin Vinny reference. Sorry, guys.
I do like it's very subtle, but the guitar strumming in it is just very unusual.
That clock ticking.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In the song, too. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, Hyman said that was inspired by his mother's wind-up clock.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I hit number 1 on the Billboard Hot 100. Mm-hmm.
deservedly.
And it certainly, in my mind, set her apart from Madonna, because I was comparing them in my head.
Yeah.
Like, oh, she's like a punk rocker or something is what I thought, because I didn't know what a punk rocker was, but she had red hair and crazy clothes and stuff, so I assumed she was a punk.
Yeah.
And this kind of changed my mind.
And I don't think Madonna got to songs like this until a little later.
Yeah. All right, Don, what did you think was important for us to talk about?
Yeah, well, I think we had to talk about Girls Just Wanna Have Fun. Yep. So, Girls Just Wanna Have Fun was written originally by Philadelphia rock musician Robert Hazard in 1979, but it was originally written from a male perspective.
That's weird.
Yeah, about rejecting parental pressure and just wanting freedom. But yeah, I guess Chertoff convinced her to record it and flip it to a female's perspective.
Yeah, the producer seems to have captured some of her magic, and the two hoots being collaborators on the arrangements and stuff, I think was awesome.
Yeah.
And knowing that song previously was like parents pushing a guy to get married, and he's like, ah, girls just want to have fun, this dismissive thing. Mm-hmm. And she totally flips it. I mean, just a female singing it changes it, but the whole thing is, you know, when the working day is done, and it's sort of like, we are just like you.
Yeah.
We work hard. We want to have fun at the end of the day, and we're not going to be dismissed for it.
Yeah, it's very similar to what Aretha Franklin did with R-E-S-P-E-C-T.
Yes.
Yeah, I think, maybe at some point in my life, I had kind of just dismissed it as sort of this, you know, just novelty artifact from the time. But a few years ago, I, you know, really was kind of digging into the song, and it's really just so well constructed. You know, I mean, the instrumentation is perfect. Her vocals are just, I don't know. I mean, she's such a weird voice because she is not a traditional singer, you know, and it's not beautiful in the way that we, you know, generally want our singers to be. But I mean, you know, she just has this, you know, unique approach to singing that works on a track like this and on a track like Time After Time.
But did you ever try to sing along to this?
Yes.
She's hitting notes like,
yeah, it's crazy.
Effortless. It sounds effortless, but then as you're singing along, you realize that it's hit another octave and that you can't do it.
Yeah.
And that's the hidden beauty, I think, because of the carefree kind of, you know, energetic vibe and her unique persona. I think people overlooked just how powerful her voice was. Even in a pop song like that. Sometimes it's not really a cover. It's a reimagination. I feel like that's what this is.
Absolutely.
All right, so why don't we close it out with the final track, Yeah, Yeah. Do you hear now that I'm more familiar with Oingo Boingo, this is super boingo-y.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this song in particular really has that kind of new wave vibe.
Well, and then that like sort of ominous synth, a creepy synth thing, and then the Betty Boop things, which I think, and so that was a short track before this is He's So Unusual, which is a cover of a 1929 song where the singer of that did kind of a Betty Boopy thing. And since she uses that voice throughout the track, and it kind of closes the album with like the more eccentric side of Cindy.
Yeah.
Lyrically, I'm not 100% sure what it's about.
No.
I think it's just kind of like a punkish carnival cross with a pep rally and ad libs and just chaotic and artistic and having fun. And maybe that's.
Yeah.
Sort of the way they wanted to close this thing with sort of a circus.
Yeah, it's very chaotic.
She's so unusual.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And by the way, the original is a totally boring, because Yeah, Yeah is a cover as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some like Swedish singer-songwriter.
Michael Rickfors. But she reimagines it, and it's playful and synth-infused and new wave, and the other one was very drab.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well. Well, it seems like it may be time to rewind and reflect on She's So Unusual. We'll kick it off with my clickbait headline. Red hair, bold personality, and hooks you'll never forget. Cyndi Lauper is so unusual, you'll never look at pop the same. Indeed. So known for her unique blend of pop, rock, new wave, blues, under the radar vocal prowess, and unapologetic individuality really did counter the era's sleek pop and stuck out like a sore thumb in the best way.
Yeah. But at the same time, it still sort of embraced it because there is a lot of slickness to this album, I think.
But you don't hear it, you know, at least for me, because I just have the vintage clothing shop quirky vibe, you know?
Yeah. That's a good point. And it's hard to separate Cyndi Lauper, the personality, from the record.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
She was Hot Topic before there was Hot Topic. That's, you know what I mean?
That's true. Yeah, my clickbait headline is similar to yours. Lauper adds unusual voice to 80s pop landscape. And I really think, I mean, just beyond her personality, just her voice is, you know, really, you know, something special. And, you know, I think if you gave these songs to Madonna or Diana Ross or somebody, it just wouldn't be the same.
No. Well, and, you know, her work after this, like True Colors and stuff, she starts to be able to really let the voice shine as mm-hmm. as her career moves forward. All right, Killer to Filler. You have any other favorites you wanted to mention?
It wasn't a single. When You Were Mine is a Prince cover, you know, which happened to be on the album you just mentioned a couple of weeks ago, Dirty Mind.
Yeah, I thought that was funny.
Yeah, you know, I think her version of that song is really, really strong. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, the other singles on the record were She Bop and All Through the Night. Yeah, I think both of those are well executed.
Yeah, well, you know, She Bop had its own mystique because the potential ode to female autonomy. You know, there was a lot of rumors that it was about playing with yourself, which is mm-hmm. the term thrown around when I was a little kid. That's what people used to say. And it was on the PMRC's Filthy 15 list a couple of years later, the Parents Music Resource Center, because of its perceived sexual content. So that was always intriguing about that song. Mm-hmm. She bop, he bop, they bop, we all bop.
Yeah. But it's a catchy tune beyond that. Yeah. And then, I mean, towards the end of the album, some of the others they just don't stand out, you know, like Witness.
I'll Kiss You was one I thought was a little weaker.
Yeah, I agree with that. Witness is kind of all right as well. Maybe kind of ska sounding.
Yeah, playing around with stuff. I mean, you know, the Men at Work played with that too, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think like a lot of pop records of the 1980s, the singles really stand out.
Yeah. Like we mentioned, All Through the Night. Did you listen to the original one by Jules Shear?
I did.
Super folky, very. I mean, it was transformed by her. I mean, it was a good, right. I think the folk song was good too, but All Through the Night, just the way she sings it carries so much more emotion.
With the harmonies, you know, the adding that higher part to it really makes the song, I think.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's one of my favorites on there as well. Yeah, and the He's So Unusual is weird, but it's a nice lead-in for which I think was the whole idea, to play with that Betty Boopy thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So production-wise, Chertoff mixes new wave pop rock and the synthesizer-based arrangements, but the layered vocals, the diversity of the instrumentation really helps Cyndi's expressive range get highlighted.
Yeah.
And it balances polish with quirk, like, really well.
Yeah, that's it right there. Yeah, balancing the polish with the quirk. They nail it.
Replayable for you there, Don Stintz?
Yes. Yeah, it's definitely one I'll revisit. I think, you know, as a whole, it's not a perfect album, but I mean, it has so many strong songs on it that, you know, that I will definitely listen to it.
Yeah, I mean, my wife bought this for me on vinyl. It's really nice to have and listen to that way, because it really took me back being able to do, you know, the first four tracks and you flip it, and it really did send me back to 1983 in the best way. Legacy-wise, I mean, a historic debut. I mean, the four top five Billboard Hot 100 singles redefined female pop stardom, allowing someone to be an individual and colorful and expressive And it remains a definitive document of early 80s pop creativity and the empowerment that came with it.
Yeah. And beyond the album, just her personality. I mean, she was just all over MTV. And she was such a symbol for that era. And then, I mean, she even got involved in like wrestling.
Yeah.
And,
oh, that whole tie-in with the WWF at the time, I think, got her in front of the heartland folk, mm-hmm. you know, regular people, not tastemakers in LA and New York City.
Yeah, she's kind of a blueprint for how, you know, women in you know, popular music could assert control over their image and sound mm-hmm. and songwriting.
Indeed. So, She's So Unusual is a fearless, colorful statement of individuality and joy that still sparkles decades later. Check it out.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
All right. So, on your way back from, was it Endor that the Ewoks were from?
I think it was Endor. So, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
The Battle of Endor. Did you have a chance to dig any other music?
Don't get me started on how those teddy bears ruined a movie.
You didn't like the Yub Yub song at the end?
No. Now, if Cyndi Lauper had done a cover of Yub Yub, then that probably would have been good.
That's upset.
Yes, I did find some other things. One album, actually, that I knew was coming at one point last year and then missed its release in November is by an old favorite of ours, Don, a band that we both kind of discovered together on a reality show in the early 2000s. It's Flickerstick and their new album, Superluminal. Flickerstick are an American alternative rock band from the Dallas-Fort Worth area, first gaining national attention in the early 2000s after winning VH1's Bands on the Run series. We went and saw them on the subsequent Celebration tour.
Yeah.
Superluminal. I think this is 20 years since their last real album. 11 songs. It's got a blend of psychedelic, cinematic, classic rock elements. It's about time and aging and reflection. I get it. I totally understand. So why don't we listen to a little bit of Your Heart is a Fortress? Seems like they've evolved. Mm-hmm. So I've listened to it a few times. It's pretty strong. It definitely is more mature than what they were doing back in the early 2000s. But that's probably a good thing.
I've liked what I've heard so far.
All right. And then back to my vinyl collection and the year 1983. And an album I would have loved to have done if we had done quote-unquote metal for 83, Def Leppard's Pyromania. This was probably the first time I was like air guitaring. Yeah. So Def Leppard, English hard rock band from Sheffield, pioneers of the 80s glam metal and arena rock sound, known for that polished production. Thank you, Mutt Lang. Catchy hooks, multi-layered vocals, and Pyromania was their third album, commercial breakthrough, and featured songs like Photograph, Rock of Ages, and my personal favorite at the time, Foolin'. Around this time, I remember trying to start a band. I was like, I was still in elementary school, and I got my dad's electric guitar out and plugged it into his amp, and it kept shocking me. So I used one of my little sister's building blocks as a pick so that I wouldn't get shocked.
Oh my God. Nice.
What about you, Don? What have you been digging on?
I kind of struggled finding, good things this week, but I did land on something from a band called Homefront, an album from this past year called Watch It Die. They're a Canadian post-punk band from Edmonton. Graham McKinnon and Clint Fraser have actually been around a long time, but some people have coined their sound as Bootwave.
Okay.
Yeah. Here's a little bit of Light Sleeper.
Sounds about right. Is there a little Bauhausiness there, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, it's like synth-driven stuff, but the vocal delivery is kind of not quite like hardcore, but it's very aggressive sounding. Yeah, it's interesting. I've spent some time with it. I'm enjoying it.
Very Canadian.
Another band, I actually saw these guys open for the Cure a few years ago, a Scottish indie rock band called The Twilight Sad. They just released an album.
Great band name.
Yes. Their album just came out this year. It's The Long Goodbye. Here's a track called Designed to Lose.
Yeah, as long as I can picture the lead singer with their hair hanging in their eyes, which I do, then it's a winner for this type of music.
Sure.
This is they've been around a while. This is their sixth album, but you know, unlike some of the other kind of moody, dark stuff I listen to, this one has a kind of, you know, real energy to it. Usually, you know, very kind of emotional and some heavy guitar. So
nice,
check that out. So what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials: Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Album Nerds.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, it's about the time in the show when I feel a disturbance in the Force. And I'm reminded of the words of Obi-Wan Kenobi, played by Sir Alec Guinness in 1983's Return of the Jedi. And he said, "You'll find many of the truths that we cling to depend greatly on our own point of view."
Wise fella.
Indeed. With that in mind, let's bring out the Wheel of Musical Discovery to see what kind of albums from 1984 we'll be talking about next time.
Next time, we continue our I Love the 80s series with 1984. From heartfelt twang to thunderous riffs, we dive into country and metal, spotlighting two albums that capture the contrasting sounds and bold spirit of the mid-80s.
Metal, a week late.
Yeah, it seems like it's deliberately like picking the genres that would have been good the year before or the year after.
Yeah, so country and heavy metal will be our sandbox for 1984, so let's find some good stuff.
Well, what are your favorite records from 1983 and 1984? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com or follow us on Instagram and other social media at Album Nerds. And please visit albumnerds.com to listen to all 323 episodes. And the best way to support this show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you so much for joining us here on the Album Nerds podcast. It's going to be a magical 1984.
All right, you ready for your 80s theme song?
Hit me.
This one might stump you. I'm going to challenge you.
We'll see.
Spin your cares away. Clear is for another day.
Fraggle Rock.
Oh, okay. Let the records play.
Here on Album Nerds.
There it is. That's what I was going to do. I didn't think you had HBO.
I didn't, but I saw it once at my grandparents' house and committed it to memory.
It was very good.
Gotcha. All right, see you in 84, everybody.